Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the What to Read Next podcast. This podcast is hosted by Laura Amin, a voracious reader of romance and young adult novels. In this podcast, Laura interviews fellow readers and authors and asks them for book recommendations of what we should read next. We hope you enjoy it. Welcome to the What to Read Next podcast. We're happy to have you back, so let's introduce ourselves.
Well, I'm Keziah Frost, and I am the author of The Reluctant Fortune Teller, which is published by Park Row, Harlequin, HarperCollins. And it was released in March of 2018, and this is my debut novel. And I am talking from my home office where there are five little dogs. So you might hear a yap or a yip, and that's what that's all about.
I love it. And I'm Laura, and it's been a good reading month, although I have not read a lot of psychological thrillers, but I read historical fiction and lots of nonfiction this month. Now, Keziah, you're a published author, so let's talk about your journey to get your debut novel published. What was the process look like? What inspired you to write the story? Tell us all about it.
Oh, I'd love to tell you all about it. Well, it started actually when I was in fifth grade, and I was having a lot of trouble with math, and I had a fantastic teacher that year. Her name was Mrs. Keene, and she was that kind of teacher. I think everybody gets one at some point in their life, who looks for the kid's strengths. She looks for a way to encourage and help. And so I was having a terrible time with math, but one thing that I did do a lot of that was getting positive attention was I was writing a lot of poems and stories, and she would have me come up to the front of the room and read my stories. And at first I was afraid to do it. I thought the kids would call me teacher's pet, but they didn't. They all leaned forward in their seats, and they laughed at the funny parts, and they looked forward to my coming up and reading in front of the class. But as I mentioned, math was not my thing at all, and my mother was very worried about it, and she went to talk to the teacher because my math level was very low. And Mrs. Keene, bless her heart, said, "Oh, your daughter doesn't need to worry about math because she's going to write wonderful books someday and entertain people." Mm. So from that day, my mother never nagged me about math again because a teacher who was an authority figure told her that she didn't have to worry about it. So as a result, I never tried at math again. And what I did was I put all of my attention into reading and writing. And that was a long time ago. And we have to understand, Laura, for me, it was like this was a contract with my fifth grade teacher that I didn't have to do the math, but I would have to write the book. And the problem is I never did write the books, and the decades started going by and I still hadn't written the book. So as I got into my 30s and then I got into my 40s, I started to get a little anxious thinking, am I ever going to write this book? And finally, when I was in my 50s, I started writing my book. And it was really important to me because, like I said, it was a contract with that teacher who let me off the hook for math all those years ago. Mm. So, so that's kind of how it started, you know, way back in fifth grade. But I really started writing in earnest only about 2 years ago. I got very serious about it. And I signed up for a class, an online class with Faber Academy UK, so it's in England. And I think I would advise anybody of your audience who would like to write a book, sign up for a class like that, like a novel writing class that might last 5 months or so, that will take you through the basic part of your work and will give you deadlines. That's the big thing, to have externally imposed deadlines. That was huge. Feedback from others was huge. And also I was in a local writers group and I was getting feedback from them. And that was very helpful too. So those are some things that I did that helped me actually complete the novel. Because I did try. When I was in my 30s and 40s, I did try, but I always just gave up because I didn't have these other elements in line, which, you know, again, I would say anybody who wants to write should have a writer's group, should be in a class, have these deadlines. Yeah,
I can imagine. I think that makes a difference. You know, you accomplish something by knowing that there's a deadline.
Deadlines. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, you feel like a sense of responsibility that you have to do it, which, you know, sometimes we don't feel that when it's just ourselves reading it. Mm-hmm. So I'll tell you a little bit about the novel, if you like, and how the idea came.
Yeah, I would love to.
Okay. Well, so I'd been writing a short story and sharing it with my local writers group at the library. And they said, your short story is too packed, full of things going on. This really needs to be developed into a novel. You need more room for this.
Mm-hmm.
So I was riding in the car with my daughter, Claire, and I was saying to her, I'd like to write a novel using these characters that are in my short story, but I don't know what to write the novel about. What would be the overarching plot to get these characters into? And she said, I've got an idea. Why don't you write a novel about a fortune teller who doesn't believe in the fortunes, and yet they keep coming true? And I thought, oh, I think that's the idea. So I went to work on it. And so in the story that I'd been working on, it was all about older people. And I don't know why. I didn't decide to write about older people on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, these were the characters that came and this is how old they were. So they were in their 70s and 80s for some reason. I don't know why. It's just the age they were. And one was Norbert, and he was very quiet, unassuming, in the background. People talk over him. Nobody notices him. And then there's Carlotta, and she's a big boss cow, and she's in charge of everything, and she's very controlling. And then there are several other characters, too, of course. And I thought at first, okay, who would like to be a fortune teller? Carlotta, because she likes to tell people what to do. And then I thought, no, that would be too obvious. Let's take Norbert out of the shadows and make him be the fortune teller and let him develop. What would happen to him, even though he's 73 years old? How could he develop and change and grow if he's put in a brand new role like this that's so unusual to him? So this is my fortune teller. What happens in the book is Norbert has been an accountant all his life, very practical, responsible person, but he has been too generous to his mooching relatives, and he's given away a lot of money, and now he's very broke. Mm. And the ladies who are in his art group notice this. They're in his art league. So they come to his house, and they have an idea. They want him to become the town fortune teller, and they'll teach him how to read cards. And he says, absolutely not. That would not be ethical. I don't believe in things like that. No way would I do that. But as you and your listeners can imagine, facts conspire to make him change his mind and consider it. So that's our starting point for the reluctant fortune teller.
I'm so excited. I have the book, so I'm planning to read it. And now I'm like curious to just pick it up. Like, I need you to read it.
Oh, great. That's really nice to hear.
That's awesome. So talk to us about the journey of getting published, because that's just something that not everyone gets to do. So I'm curious to hear, what was the process like? Did you get an agent? How did that whole process took place?
You're right. Not everybody gets to do it. And I think a big part of it is persistence, really believing in your project and not giving up. That's a big part of it. And there must be luck involved. The stars must have to align. I'm not really sure. It still seems surreal to me that I actually got published. But the way I did it was, first I finished my rough draft.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a book of 60,000 words. I never thought I could do it. It took me about I think, about 9 months from the time I got the idea to take this character out of my short story and make a novel to the time I wrote the end on the manuscript. It was probably about 9 months, I think. And then came the challenge of figuring out how to get an agent. So I just researched online how to get an agent, just like anybody would do. I had no idea. I will say to all those aspiring writers out there, there's a great website that you should look at, and it is called hashtag MSWL. M as in Mary, S as in Sam, W, L as in Larry. So it stands for Manuscript Wish List. This is a website where agents have tweeted what they're looking for, and someone has archived it all on this website. So you can go to this website and see who are the agents who are actively looking right now for what you have to sell, so that you don't waste your time or their time sending out your project to somebody that, you know, maybe they only do children's literature, or they only do historical fiction or nonfiction or something like that. This will help you really streamline your search for an agent. So I recommend that. And then there's another website that would be very important for your listeners too, and that would be Query Tracker. On Query Tracker, you keep track of all the queries that you send out, because you will send out so many that you will forget when you sent them, who you sent them to. And so this is something that helps you keep track. And you have to really pay attention to what exactly agents are looking for. Some of them only want to see the first 10 pages. Some of them want to see the first chapter. So you have to pay attention, follow instructions. Also, the way you write the email, very important, because agents get so many unsolicited manuscripts and so many emails that they are basically going through, this is my understanding anyway, they're going through and looking for a reason to reject each one. They have to, because they get just thousands. So you don't want to give them any reason to reject it. So you don't want to make a mistake about their name. That's really important. You don't want to make any kind of mistakes in your email. And you want to let them know in the email how you found out about them, why you're sending it to them in particular. You don't want it to just be to be like, dear agent. You know, you want it to be personalized to the specific agent. And you will probably send out 100 of these. They say don't give up until you've sent out at least 100. Which is why you need a website to keep track of it all. It's a lot.
A lot of persistence.
A lot of persistence. And I was fortunate. I sent out 40, and I had some interest from a couple of agents, well, a few agents. But I chose the agent that I have because I just felt it, you know, very much of a click with her. I really felt that she got my work, and that she was interested in working with me on making it better too. So not all agents want to work with you on making it better. Some of them don't do any editing, but and I wasn't expecting an agent to do any editing at all. But actually, the agent that I have has a very good eye for that. But you know, you can't count on that at all. You really have to get it as good as you possibly can and as perfect as you know how to do it. And then there's going to be plenty of edits and plenty of things that you're going to have to change or take out or move around, because no matter how perfect you try and get it, it's going to need improvement, of course.
Yeah, I can imagine. How do you get published?
How did it get published?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I forgot that part. Huh. Well, so then my agent, and her, I don't know if I mentioned her name. Her name is Danielle Bukowski. And she shopped it out to the different publishing companies. And this subsidiary of HarperCollins, which I mentioned before, it's called Park Row, they said yes. That's how it happened.
That's amazing. So it was like 2-year-long process to get from the idea to the debut novel?
You know, I think it was even faster than that. It seemed very fast because I think it was about 9 months for me to write it. And then all of the edits, including what I did with the agent and then what I did with the publishing company, that all took about 6 months, I think, if I remember correctly at this point. It was kind of a whirlwind for me. And so, I guess it was about 15 months of that. And then, I think the publishing date, I'm not really sure how long it took, but it was less than 2 years ago. Now, the book came out in March. So, it might have been something like that, like 18 months or, close to 2 years. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. That's really great to hear.
Thank you. I'm pretty excited still.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's not exciting. It's like you had a published book. That's something to be proud of.
Thank you. Thank you. And I really am. You know what the best thing is, too, is when you hear back from people who have read it and they liked it or they loved your main character. Or I think one of the emails I got back that touched me the most was somebody said she'd been going through a very hard time in her life and she picked up that book and it made her laugh and smile and helped her get through it. And that really means a lot.
Mm, yeah, I can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Now we want to chat all things book with you. So what is your go-to genre?
You know, that is, that's a tricky one. I do like, I don't know if I could say one. Okay. I like literary fiction a lot.
Okay.
I like funny books, Laura. I'll tell you, I really like them. If an author can make me laugh, I give that author high marks. I really think it's much easier to scare people maybe than it is to make them laugh. It's much easier to give people a creepy feeling in writing than it is to make a successful joke or a laugh line. And I do like thrillers, too. I like the domestic thrillers.
Mm-hmm.
But I think even more, I like a book that can make me laugh.
Mm.
And it can be a book that has elements of mystery or thriller or literary or what have you. But if it can make me laugh, that just means a lot. One example, I would say, here's a recent book that's one of my favorites, The Rosie Project by Graham Simsion. Mm-hmm. That is a very funny book, and it's an important book. It's very popular, The Rosie Project. It's about a man who has Asperger's syndrome, so of course, socially awkward, can't really figure out the social thing very well. And it's he decides he needs a wife, and how is he going to go about that when he has no social skills?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a book that makes fun of him in any way. When I say it's funny, it's not mocking funny,
mm-hmm.
because you are completely, as you're reading it, you're completely empathetic with the character, and you're laughing in understanding, you're laughing in appreciation of how hard everything is for him. You're laughing at how he doesn't get things that other people get, but it's not in a way that makes him less than. It's in a way that you're appreciating him because you get him. You get the way he thinks. So it really increases your empathy as a reader to help you understand what it would be like to have Asperger's. I think it's a very good book.
Yeah, that's a really good book. So what are some of your other favorite books?
You know, interesting question, because when I wanted to write a book, I thought, okay, I need to pick a genre. What genre would I write in if I wrote a book? And I didn't know. And so I went around my house and I gathered up all of my favorite books and put them on one shelf so that I could look at them and figure it out. And I found a very funny thing, which is a lot of the books that I really like are almost 99% British, which is funny because I'm American. And there, so many of them are from the 1930s, which is really strange. And I never consciously chose books that were British or the 1930s, but I can see a clear pattern. I'm looking at the pile of books on my shelf right now, and it's pretty easy to see that that's kind of where they fall. It's not all of the books. I do like others too, but some examples of 1930s British would be P.G. Woodhouse. He wrote books about My Man Jeeves, Right Ho Jeeves. These are books about an aristocratic man and his valet. And they're very, very funny. And, Cold Comfort Farm by Stella Gibbons. And The Enchanted April. Now, that was made into a movie, I think, in the 90s. The Enchanted April might be my favorite book ever. It's the most beautiful book. It's funny and it's also deep. It has psychological insight and it takes place in a beautiful place in Italy. So it takes you to a beautiful surrounding. These are some of my favorites. I do like Sarah Waters. She's a British writer. Another book that came out recently that I like is The Snow Child. I don't know how to say her name. Eowyn Ivey. That's an interesting one. That one is based on a Russian fairy tale. And it's about a couple who always wanted to have children and they never could. And one day they went out and built with the snow a snow child. And they put cranberry on the lips and they put blueberries in the eyes. And then they went into their little house and went to sleep. And in the morning, the snow child came alive. And there are different versions of this story. It kind of reminds us of the Gingerbread Man. Well, this author has written a version of this fairy tale that takes place in Alaska in the 1920s, I believe. And it's magical realism. And it is so interesting because she is able to bring in this snow child and you're never sure if you're supposed to believe that the snow child is real, or if you're supposed to believe that they're hallucinating, or if you're supposed to believe that it's metaphorical. You never quite know because the author has such a delicate touch with it all.
That's a really interesting book. Let me pick it up.
It's very good.
So what have you read in the past month, and what did you enjoy about each book?
Well, let's see. The Hypnotist Love Story is a really good one. Now, that's by Leanne Moriarty, and I think everybody loves Leanne Moriarty. Anybody who reads her loves her. She's Australian, and I think the first book she wrote, or at least the first one I knew about, was called What Alice Forgot. That is funny and fascinating. And she tends to write about people who are in their, I would say, 30s, something like 30 to 45, that range. So there's a lot about young moms and neighborhoods and things like that. And she has a lot of humor, but there's also suspense, and there are also real-life social issues. So, but The Hypnotist Love Story I really like because, you know, the hypnotist in the story is a woman who has this beautiful office with big windows looking out on the ocean in Australia. And one day she gets this new client and she's going to, you know, work with her with hypnosis. And it turns out that this new client is actually the ex-wife of the man that the hypnotist is dating. The hypnotist doesn't know it. She thinks this is just a client coming in off the street. But this woman wants to get into the hypnotist's office because she wants to know who is this woman that her ex-husband is dating. She wants to find out about her. So you begin to get a very creepy feeling that something very bad is in the works here, because this woman seems a little bit, I don't know, maybe not very well balanced, you know. And eventually the hypnotist finds out that this new boyfriend of hers is being stalked by his ex-wife. Mm-hmm. And still the reader knows that the hypnotist has already met the ex-wife, but the hypnotist doesn't know it yet. So Leanne Moriarty does a very good job of building the suspense and letting you know things just as you need to know them. She's really good. Mm-hmm. So I like her a lot. You know, another book I'm reading is Pride and Prejudice. Yeah. Have you ever read that one?
Yes, I have. And I read quite a few retellings. It's one of my favorite tropes is the retelling of Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah? Well, what retellings have you read?
There's Pride. There's a Curtis Sittenfeld retelling. She wrote a retelling. There's one as a debutante format. I think it's a debutante season, I think. There's quite a few. There's from YA. There's actually Diverse Weeds. There's Grown Up Pride and Prejudice. So, yeah.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, there's been quite a few retellings for that story. It's a really great story. Bridget Jones's is a retelling of Pride and Prejudice. So.
Ah, yes. That's very interesting. You know, I keep trying to get through Pride and Prejudice, and I don't know why I'm not finishing it, because I like it. When I'm reading it, I'm laughing.
Mm-hmm.
But, I am finding that, you know, I read other books while I'm reading it, so it's kind of a slow path for me. But when you talked about retelling, do you know about the book Jane Steele by Lindsay Fay?
No, because what's the book about?
You will love it because you like the retellings.
Mm-hmm.
This is based on Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte.
Ooh.
Oh, yes. And, you know, there's a point, I think it's at the very end, or maybe towards the end, where Jane Eyre says, "Reader, I married him." Well, in this one, Jane Steele says, "Reader, I murdered him." So Jane Steele, instead of going through life being a victim of all these awful men in Victorian life, the men who were so entitled to be so awful to women, she just murders them one after the other. And I know it sounds awful to laugh, but it's very much that, you know, that dark humor, and it's very funny, and you are cheering the murderess the whole way. You were just thinking, because she makes these awful people so awful that it's quite all right with you when she pushes them over a cliff or whatever she does. So it's written in the style of Jane Eyre. So it's very much that flowery Victorian writing. And I think it's a really good book. Jane Steele by Lindsay Fay.
I got so many book recommendations. I love this podcast for that reason. So,
you know, one of my favorites recently, I don't know if you read The Woman in the Window by A.J. Finn.
No, it's been buzzed about, actually. I heard it for some time. So,
So much buzz. I actually listened to it rather than read it.
Okay.
The narrator in the audio version is great.
Mm-hmm.
And oh my gosh, was that suspenseful, well-paced, well-written, I thought. I mean, I was completely captivated by that book.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would recommend The Woman in the Window by H. A. Finn. What else have I read? You know, another one for funny books. I don't know if you know Amy Sedaris. Everybody seems to know David Sedaris, her more famous brother.
Yeah.
But Amy Sedaris is extremely funny, and she's written a couple of books. And one of them is called I Like You. Mm-hmm. And It's very funny. It's just, it's like a hostess kind of book, and how you should serve things and how you should make people comfortable in your home. But it's ridiculous and hilarious, and there's lots of pictures in it, and there's recipes in it, and I don't know. I just think it's a really amusing book.
I love me some recipes. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Eleanor Oliphant is completely fine.
Yeah.
That's another buzz book, isn't it?
Yeah, that's another buzz book, but it's amazing.
Oh, you read it. Did you read it?
Yeah, I did. I read Eleanor. She's great.
She is great.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's like she's so open and she's so honest about the things that she says. She has like no filter. It's amazing.
Yes. Yes. That one gave me a feeling very much like the Rosie Project, mm-hmm. where you are laughing, but it's not a cruel kind of mocking laughter, laughing at the character at all. You're identifying with her and cheering her on and, you know, hoping that she does well the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah, Eleanor Oliphant is very good. Very well written, I thought. Yeah, so that's a good one. You know, another one, Girl Waits with Gun.
Mm-hmm.
That is by Amy Stewart, and she has a series out. And I think the first one is Girl Waits with Gun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's based on a historical family of three sisters around the year 1910, and it's well-researched, it's intelligent, but at the same time, it's entertaining, it's funny, it's quick-paced, it's satisfying. So I would recommend Girl Waits with Gun as another book that's recently come out. Well, actually, she's got, as I said, it's a series, so now, you know, there's later books in the series that have come out. But I really admire her as a writer, very much so.
I love it. These are great recommendations. That's awesome.
Mm. And what about you? What are you reading?
So I'm reading Robert Galbraith, I don't know how to say his last name, which is J.K. Rowling's book series. So I'm reading The Cuckoo's Calling. I just started this week, so...
Oh, what do you think so far?
So far, I have no feelings. It's not Harry Potter. And you are coming in, so I'm not expecting Harry Potter.
Yes.
For the story to grab me. I heard the books are really good, but I'm waiting for the story to just kind of like grab my attention. It's just not, it hasn't gotten me, but I'm only less than 10%. So I just started.
Yeah, that's such an interesting thing, isn't it? J.K. Rowling writing something besides Harry Potter, and she's writing something very, very different, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about a detective. It's about a murder mystery. So it seems to be in line with the theme of autumn, where it's like, you know, mystery thrillers and whatnot. So I'm looking forward to it.
So it's all about adults then, is it? It's
yeah.
Not kids.
Yeah, there's no magic. There's no muggles. There's no Hogwarts. It's a straight up adult set in London of a detective trying to figure out a murder mystery.
Now, here's something I wonder, Laura. If you would read that book and not know that it was J.K. Rowling, which, of course, it's impossible because now you can't not know it because you know it. But if you could imagine this book just comes across your desk and you read it, how would that affect your feelings about it as opposed to knowing, oh, this is what J.K. Rowling is doing now? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does it kind of like, is there an inevitable disappointment that it's not Harry Potter?
No, I don't feel disappointed that it's not Harry Potter. I'm kind of like curious to hear. I think I'm more willing to invest the time now, because this book is like 500 pages. So there's an investment in time for this book that I probably wouldn't do for any other new author to me.
Mm-hmm.
Author to me, and it has like a 600 page book. I need to actually have some reviews behind it to tell me that's worthwhile the time, because it's an investment. I keep count of how many books I read. So I like to read more books than normal. So I think that's, you know, so if I'm reading a 600 page book, that could take away from a 300-page book or a couple of 200 books that I could have read. So it's one of those things where I have to look at reviews and see if it's worthwhile. But the reviews for this one, people have raved about it. So I'm curious to see what it's all about.
Yeah, so you have confidence in her because are you a Harry Potter fan?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So then you have confidence that she can pull it off. She can create a great story with a great pace, great characters, great payoff.
Yeah, I think that's what it's an author that, you know, one of my favorite book series is Harry Potter. So it's like, I know it's a trusted author. I think just kind of like going with it. It's not her series. It's a different series. It's a different genre all itself. It's not young adult, middle grade, you know, chapter books. It's actually an adult series.
It's very brave of her to branch off. I can certainly see why she chose another name. Do you happen to know, did she want people to know that J.K. Rowling was behind this pen name, or did she want to keep that secret?
I think it was secret at some point, and then she came out with that. But it's touted as in the synopsis, it says J.K. Rowling's pen name. So it's not a secret anymore.
It's not a secret anymore, no.
It's the synopsis. It's like J.K. Rowling's writing as Robert Galbraith, or however they say his last name. But I know because she didn't have a good success writing, she wrote an adult book under J.K. Rowling, and it didn't do well. Like, people complain about it and bitch about it. So I think in some ways she tried to use a pen name, I think, to kind of like separate from the identity of Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'll be very interested to hear what you finally think when you finish it, because I don't know if I would pick up a 500-page book. I rarely do that. I'm, you know, like you, maybe for a different reason. You read an incredible amount of books every year. I mean, much more than I do. I think I read maybe one or two books a week. I think you, in a week, you probably read five, or I don't know. You read a lot of books.
Yeah, right now I'm reading about two or three books on average, but there was one point I was reading six or seven books a week. So,
wow.
Yeah. So it's just a matter of, like, you know, how fast and how much and stuff. My average has slowed down because I've read different genres, so it's just shifted. But yeah, I used to read a book a day. That was used to be my thing.
Wow, that's a lot of books. You know, I don't really like books that are door stoppers, as they call them, these 500-page books. I don't, because I don't think I have the attention span or something to stick with a book that long. When I look at the books that are my favorites, which they're right here on my shelf, they tend to be about 60,000 words. They tend to be more narrow volumes. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at right now The Haunting of Hill House. That's on my favorite. The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson, which is a great book to read around Halloween time. You know, that's a narrow book. Most of the books that I love are just narrow books, because I think so many books seem too long to me. I get into about two-thirds or three-fourths of the way, and I go, okay, now it's getting padded. Now we're just filling in. You know, I get the idea. Stop repeating yourself. Let's get to the end. That's how I usually feel when I'm reading a book. So, I don't know. For Charles Dickens, I do it. For Charles Dickens, I will read a doorstopper, but it's hard for me to pick up a really thick book and stick with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for me, you know, it has to be kind of recommendations. I think the next doorstopper that I'm reading is Pachinko. And I heard really good recommendations from Bookstagram, but I've heard really good recommendations from one of my good friends. So a lot of times it just depends on the recommendations. If they're telling me it's like a must read, then I'll pick it up. But if I'm hearing mixed reviews, then I'm probably not going to pick it up.
Yeah, Pachinko. That's a book that I feel like I should read too, because people are saying they love it.
Yeah, it won quite a few awards, which is kind of awesome. So.
Yeah. Maybe that should go on my to-be read pile. My to-be read pile is crazy, Laura. I mean, I have so many. It's making me nervous, actually, as I look. I'm looking around my office right now at the to-be read piles. So now I used to have them in order of, in what order do I want to read them? I want to ask you this. What order do you put your TBR pile? Because I changed mine.
It changes. So I'm a mood reader. So there's a couple of things that change. I'm a mood reader. So there's books that I may pick up based on mood or palate cleanser. So if I read a heavier book, then I may read a palate cleanser or read a lighter book afterwards. And then there's books that I get from the library. So I use the library a lot. So now I use it for ebooks and I use it for hardbacks. So it just depends on, you know, what's available in the library and then based on recommendations. So if I have them from the library and if I have, I usually have like a stack of like 5 or 6 books from the library. And if I hear recommendations about one book, then I'll pick it up. But if I don't hear any recommendations, then I'll look at synopsis and be like, what am I feeling for? But yeah, I'm a mood reader for the most part. I don't write a list for TBR. I keep tabs of what I read. On a journal, just kind of like write down like books that I need to read for review, books that I need to read. But I read based on what I feel like it.
Okay. Yeah, I had my to be read pile. Like I tried to put what I should read next first.
Mm-hmm.
And then now I've just divided into here's all the white books. Here's all the black books. Here's all the red books.
Mm-hmm.
Because that way it looks pretty. And also it helps me to see what I have because it changes it up. But, it's very daunting, you know, a book that you buy at some point, say you're in the airport and you see a book and it's like, oh, I like this one. And I like that one. I'll buy them both. Then you read one of them on the plane and then you bring the other one home and you put it on a shelf and it sits there for a couple of years, you know, and it's just kind of like nagging you, like, you know, you bought me, you should be I don't know, I have a very guilty conscience about all these to be read books.
Yeah,
do you feel pressured by the to be read pile?
Oh my gosh, yes. I feel crushed because I read for review, so I get books from publishers before they get published, and I have one of those, and they're always daunting me. I'm like, I know I need to pick an arc, and it's like, when am I gonna pick an arc? You know, it's like putting it out there, you know, so making room for those and then making room for the books that come up that are due in the library. So, yeah.
It's so cool that you get ARCs. That is so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of cool, but there's a responsibility. You have to read the book. Oh my gosh, when am I going to read all the books? So, yeah.
Because if you didn't read the book, then the publishers might not keep sending them to you?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. So you want to read the book because, yeah, they're sending it to you in that hope that you're going to review it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, you know, I try to read those on, just try to read them on publication days. But, you know, sometimes I may just not be able to get to, and then may I read them and then still submit about a review. But, yeah, it's like there's the dynamics of getting ARCs.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just daunting, isn't it, that there are so many books coming out all the time. Like, I think every Tuesday, a bazillion gajillion books come out.
Yes. Tuesday is publication day.
Yes. I never really understood that before, how many books come out constantly.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So for any one book to make, to, you know, to stick its head up and make itself noticed above all the others, I don't know what it takes. You know, again, it's the stars aligning kind of a thing. I mean, I know publishers sometimes get behind certain books and push, but it's just incredible how many books are coming out all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is great. It's, you know, we have so much have so much to choose from now, and that's fascinating. And it's fascinating to watch genres grow, you know, domestic thrillers right now, you know, those are really huge. And it's funny, I read an article, I think it was about 5 or 6 months ago, and it said, oh, the domestic thriller is dead. We're done. No more of those. Not so much. They're still really hot.
Yeah, they are. They're still coming on. There's quite a few that are good. And there's quite a few that are not so good. But yeah.
Now, what do you think about that? Why do people love that? I mean, I would imagine it's mostly women reading them, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just, it's a fun story to get lost and to, you know, trying to figure out what's the twist, what the turn is, a page-turner. So it will grab your attention, and just hopefully you'll finish the book.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of fascinating that it's an you know, when you read a book, it's an emotional experience. And you think, why would we sometimes choose an emotional experience that's going to be so tense and worrisome and full of danger and full of problems? But maybe part of it too is when you close the book, you say, oh, well, that was just a book. That's not my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank God that's not my life. Thank God that's not it.
Yeah. It is a little bit of an escape. And it's also maybe an exploring, like, you know, what would I do if I had this problem? What would I do? You know, what is the heroine going to do? How's she going to solve this? How's she going to get out of it? Can I learn something from this?
Yeah.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think that's where it's like the twists and turns. It's like, would I do this, or do I trust this narrator, or do I don't trust this narrator, or this specific action, is that something that annoys me or not annoys me? So.
Yeah. You know, speaking of old fiction, there is an old domestic... Well, speaking of old domestic thrillers, of course, Daphne du Maurier is the queen of those with Rebecca. She started it. But there's one by a British author. Of course, there I go with my British authors. Celia Fremlin. She wrote a book called The Hours Before the Dawn, and it is a slender volume, like I like. Mm-hmm. And it is tight, and it is absorbing. And it is fascinating. And it is about a mother, a young mother, who has three little kids. One of them is a baby who never stops crying. Mm-hmm. And this mother can't get any sleep. And the family needs to take in a boarder into their house to make ends meet. And they bring in this woman who is very strange, and there's something not quite okay about this border. And the woman, who is not getting enough sleep, is not sure if she can trust her own perceptions or not, because she's not getting enough sleep and she's getting very suspicious. And it's just a great tale. It's just, it's short and it's well done. So I would recommend that to anybody who wants to go back and look at some earlier domestic thrillers to see where they sprang from. And that's, again, The Hours Before the Dawn by Celia Fremlin, and it's British. 1950s, I think.
I love it. That sounds like an awesome book to pick up. So That concludes our show. So now we want to hear from you. What are you currently reading? So come on over to the blog, whattorednextblog.com, and share your favorite books. We have a brand new Facebook group where you can join and connect with fellow readers and get book recommendations, and join our upcoming book virtual book club next month, which we're reading The Great Alone by Kristen Hannah. To join the group, go to whattorednextblog.com/Facebook.
And thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I had so much fun, and we'll be back in a month with a brand new episode. And in the meantime, if you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review on iTunes. This will help get this podcast discovered by a new audience.
Thank you so much. I hope you have a fantastic day.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyoureadnextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.